accession number 4600, reel 4.
Flight Lieutenant Townsend, reel 4. I think that whilst you were in the Mediterranean, you had exercises with the aircraft being ferried between cruisers and carriers.
Oh yes, that's so, because the I said that if when we shot them off to do an exercise under actual war conditions, they would hopefully find a piece of dry land to pop down on afterwards. They could, of course, also land on a carrier if there was a friendly one nearby. And that we used to run exercises, in fact, where all the cruiser-borne aircraft would be fitted with wheels and catapulted off from their ships, then land on a carrier and be brought back into harbour again, after which we would... the crews from the different cruisers would go over to the carrier, fit the floats back on, and they'd then be lowered over the side and taxi back to their own ships. There was quite a scramble, in fact, when all the cruiser chaps went off to the carrier, because obviously there was only one crane to play with, and you didn't want to have to wait at the end of a long queue to get your aircraft back on board. And so when we went to the carrier to fit the floats on, we did a dirty dash over there. And we did, in fact, find that ours was the only serviceable aeroplane of the lot. All the rest had pranged one way or another. And we had the only serviceable aeroplane left. And then there was another occasion when they we did the same sort of exercise, and they landed at Abu Qir, on the RAF station at Abu Qir. And this was very sad, because our flight commander, it was Lieutenant Commander Hale, he was in HMS London. He very unfortunately, he was a very good pilot too, but he very unfortunately made the mistake of losing an engine on takeoff and trying to turn back onto his airfield, and stalled it in, and it burned. The observer actually was our own observer, and he got away with it. He managed to get out and get away with it, but the pilot was rather badly burned, and I mean, obviously this was before penicillin or sulfonamides or anything like that for treating burns and wounds, and he died in hospital about a week later, which was very sad. But anyway, this was the method of operating: either land, shoot the airplane off, then he either land on dry land or on a carrier. But they weren't very good at it. Neither were they very good at shooting either.
What was the problem with shooting?
Oh, well, the shooting was a scream, because we then we had I think it was Tiger Moths fitted with radio control, which were used as target aircraft, and I've seen a whole cruiser squadron blazing away. We had four four-inch anti-aircraft guns in the Shropshire, and I think the other county class cruisers had the same. So you get a fair number of guns, four-inch guns, belting away at one poor little Queen Bee target aircraft, flying at 10,000 feet, straight and level, dead 60 knots, if he's lucky. And, admittedly, there was some shrapnel bursting all around the airplane, but they never hit it. I've never seen one hit. They have, in fact, been hit, I know, but... certainly in my 2 years on board, I never saw one hit, and I saw a fair number of shoots. Occasionally, when they did hit them, they would change over from the ordinary charges, ordinary shells, to high-explosive ones. And you could see when they changed, because the puffs of smoke changed from whitish colour to a black one. That's when they'd gone to HE. And then sometimes they hit them with HE. But Otherwise, I'm afraid we used to make ourselves a bit unpopular by jeering at the guns crews and saying, go on, bring the bloody thing down low enough so that you can throw spuds at it, which was didn't endear us to the ship's company, but it was one of those things.
Where did you go to after HMS Shropshire?
From Shropshire, I was very overjoyed to be posted to Farnborough. My home, of course, was still at Reading, and Farnborough was only, in Hampshire was only 18 miles away. This was an absolutely splendid posting. It was about the nearest one I could possibly have had. And I went to number 53 Squadron, which had just formed, with Hawker Hectors, which was the another derivative of the Hart, but it was fitted with an Napier H engine, which was a little bit heavy, I think, for the airframe, because the a tendency was to nose them over on landing. But as by the way,
was this a more powerful engine than the Hart would have?
Yes, it was. It was a more powerful engine, and I think, if I remember right, it was also air cooled again. But it was an H configuration. The actual configuration of the engine was an H. And I think 24-cylinder, something like that. But it was back to Army Cooperation again. I never got away from Army Co-op or Navy or Fleet Air Arm and then back to Army Co-op. But I found it was quite a changed Air Force in just the 2 years that I'd been away. The expansion was on, because this was then 1937, August 1937. The expansion was underway, and I was assured afterwards by staff people that by 1937 we knew war with Germany was inevitable, and the expansion was on the go. And we started a new scheme for fairly rapid training. We called them boy entrants instead, as opposed to apprentices. And I think the boys on the signal side did something like 18 months training, you know, about half the time. And, they were good chaps, but obviously they hadn't got the training. And I found that the only other ex-apprentice on the squadron when I arrived was a chap by the name of Mitchell, and I was the second ex-apprentice. A leading air craftsman, and I'd got one good conduct badge, and, you know, I was a very rare bird indeed. And the flight sergeant, who of course was a regular and fairly old-timer at that, J.P. Copeland, he more or less welcomed me with open arms. Have another ex-apprentice. It's fantastic. But it was much too good. You see, the uniform had changed, and we could chuck away our choker collars and our peak caps and so on, and go out in slacks. We were actually allowed out in slacks, and we were allowed to be out all night. It's quite incredible, you know, in plain clothes too. And so I very quickly found this out. In fact, I think sleeping out passes were then granted while I was actually at Farnborough, and I spotted it in DROs and very hastily applied for one, and used to pop home every night in my little motor car. Obviously, I saved a bit of money when I was in Fleet Air Arm, and bought a Morris 10 for £50. 21,000 miles on the clock. Terrific.
How did 53 Squadron compare with 16 Squadron?
Oh, it was in a lot of ways, it was very, very similar. And I say the personnel were different. The average age, I suppose, had lowered. We got much younger chaps coming in, but and the Air Force was changing. It was becoming rather more liberal. But otherwise, it was still very much the same sort of Air Force, and very much the same spirit was on the go, too. It was very good. We liked it.
And how did the base at Farnborough compare with Old Sarum?
Oh, it was it was older. By the time I'd left Old Sarum, you see, although when I went there first we had very old billets which we were told had been condemned in 1918. By the time I left, we got brand new swept-up barrack blocks, which were very good indeed, much more comfortable, much more sensible. But Farnborough, we were back to fairly old stuff. But there again, you see, I hardly ever saw my bed space because I nearly always slept at home. But otherwise, and of course, it was a very long established station. You know, dear old Cody's tree there to gawk at, and
dear old what?
Cody's tree.
What
was that? There's a tree at Farm. I think it's still there, with a railing round it. That Colonel Cody used to tie up his airplane to. Back in the First War, or maybe even before that, I'm not sure. It's still there.
Did you say that by this time, August 37, that you had been told that war with Germany was inevitable?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, this was the general feeling. And, we were told this by quite senior officers that there was going to be a shooting match sooner or later.
How did you feel at that time in summer of 1937? That the RAF might perform against the German Air Force?
We were a bit bothered because, the policy, the Air Ministry policy seemed to be biplanes. Nothing else was safe except a biplane. But, in spite of the Schneider Trophy successes that we'd had in the early 30s, and the Fairey long-range monoplane, which we sent off from Cranwell while I was still there as an apprentice, which did an incredible run right down to India, I think. In spite of things like that, they still seemed to be a little bit hesitant about using monoplanes. But, again, I shall never forget, while I was actually at Farnborough on 53 Squadron, I saw my first Spitfire. And it appeared very quickly and flew over the top very fast indeed, and I was quite shattered that A, that the Air Force had monoplanes, and B, that they could go as fast as that. It was quite an eye opener, and of course the Spitfire news was getting around about it, Spitfire and the Hurricane, and we were considerably more encouraged. But obviously jumping ahead just really slightly, but it's not really irrelevant. I know we won the war because we knew that we could never be beaten. We just knew we wouldn't be beaten, period. And we felt exactly the same in 1937. Okay, frankly, we none of us joined to fight wars. It's about the last thing we thought of when we joined the Air Force, but at the same time, we knew that if there was a war, okay, we'd win it, period. No doubt.
So you think that it was morale that was a crucial factor for us in the war?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. No hesitation about that at all. In spite of bumbles and boobs and lack of equipment in a lot of cases, and poor equipment sometimes, and so on. But in spite of that, we always knew we'd win, period.
Had the wireless equipment improved when you came back to a land squadron?
Oh, yes. It had it had immeasurably. And, of course, incidentally, by the time we got the Warus in the Fleet Air Arm, we then had much more sophisticated equipment than we'd ever had before. Farnborough seemed to realise then that there were other types of valve than the simple triode, and we were getting things like tetrodes and pentodes, and things were really looking up. And also they were shifting into the HF waveband, so that you get cases of say a flying boat off the west coast of Africa working somebody in London, or working somebody in England. Ranges were going up and up and up. The whole thing was looking much more sensible. So in the Warus, we had different aircraft, different radio, much more up-to-date radio. And in fact, we were then going ahead of the getting ahead of the Navy, considerably ahead of the Navy, because they were still stuck on lots and lots of power and medium wave band. Period. And that, you know, we could outshine them all every time.
So what type of range were you achieving with WT at Farnborough?
Oh, the ordinary day-to-day routine stuff was, I suppose, the you know, the 100-150 mile sort of thing. The other, you know, you get the really long ranges. We weren't looking for, because we weren't really sending aircraft all that far away. But we knew from signals that we were picking up on the ground that, okay, some chaps were flying a heck of a long way away.
Where did you go to after Farnborough?
Well, from Farnborough, Farnborough, of course, was much too good to be true. I began being able to get home every night, playing clothes and that sort of thing, having a motor car. I'd only been there from the August until the December, and a posting came through for me to report to RAF Felixstowe. Well, the flight sergeant was very upset, and he said, "Oh, don't you worry, old lad. We'll soon get you out of this one. We can't possibly spare you." It wasn't because of my blue eyes or anything. It was just because I was only the second ex-apprentice he'd got. But anyway, he very quickly found out that it was an Air Ministry posting, and there was absolutely nothing he could do about it. And so off I had to go to Felixstowe. And when I got there, it was most odd, because I'm sure they looked at me a little bit askance at the guard room when I booked in. Sort of another one of those, you know, that sort of attitude. And they directed me to a particular hut where I was to find a bed. And when I got there, I found it was full of signals people, quite a few of whom I knew. In fact, there was one chap from my class, Joe Goddard. And I said, "Come on, Joe, what's all this about? What are we doing here?" And he said, "Well, I can't tell you." And I said, "Well, don't be so stupid, because, you've known me for a long time. And anyway, all official secrets act and all that. So what's the hesitancy?" And he said, "I'm sorry, but I just can't tell you. You'll find out in the morning. And in the morning, we should go off in plain clothes. Ignore the fact that we should be in a lorry that says RAF all over it, but we should go off in plain clothes, and well, you'll learn the rest when we get there." And which we duly did. We shoved off to the north of Felixstowe, the River Devon, and found a gentleman named Charlie Brinkley with a motorboat who ferried us across the river, and we went into Bawdsey Manor. And it was then in Bawdsey Manor that I learned about the thing which we then called RDF, which we now know as radar. And that was my introduction to it.
How was it explained to you, what it was?
Oh, it was explained in technical terms that it had been found that by pushing out very strong pulses of radio energy, that echoes could in fact be received back from aeroplanes, and that we were using this as a means of detecting their position in space. As simple as that.
What was your reaction when you heard this?
Well, frankly, I was completely shattered. I found it very, very difficult to believe. Very difficult to believe until I actually saw it working. And well, I still regard it, quite frankly, as almost incredible that a signal does come back from a target aircraft, is reflected back from a target aircraft, and that there is enough signal to detect with a sensitive radio receiver.
Did you realise the importance of it at that time?
Frankly, no, we didn't. We knew. The only importance that we recognised was for the defence of Great Britain. We knew, you see, by the time we left Bordsey, we stayed there about, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, something like that, on our training. And then we were all posted to different radar stations that were already in existence. And then we knew we'd got Bordsey, which had an operational station as well as a research establishment. We had Bordsey, we had Canewdon, the next one down the coast, outside Southend, which is where I went. And then we had we had one above Bordsey at Great Bromley, near Colchester. We had one at Dunkirk, which is not very far off Dover, on the way down to Dover. We had Dover itself, and that was it. That was the lot. That was all our radar defence. But pretty obviously, we knew it would be expanded, but we certainly never realised the significance of it, and the fact that it would be expanded to the extent that it was. One boob that I made shows a complete lack of appreciation of it, was that I thought that, okay, if war came, I would be sure to be home based. I must be on a radar station at home. Never even thought of them going abroad. And so we went on at Canewdon. It was a very, very interesting time.
Could I ask you about the security requirements that were imposed on you?
Oh yes, the. Really, it was the best kept secret of pre-war and of the wartime. Although we knew afterwards that the Germans had some radar, I'm convinced still that we were way ahead of them. And certainly we weren't letting on before the war that we had it. There were lots of questions from passers-by. Any radar station, what are you doing there with those 240-foot wooden towers? They were quite a distinctive feature of the landscape, but no one let on, in spite of the lots of questions. And I'm sure everybody else was like myself. You know, you didn't even tell your parents or your friends or anybody anything about it at all. And I know our civilian driver, for example, at Canewdon was a retired policeman, Bill Martin. And I actually had digs with him. And he had some sort of idea that it was something to do. He couldn't help but know it was something to do with radio. But even he didn't know what we were up to. He really didn't know what we were doing and what the equipment was capable of.
But he knew that you were in a secret.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. It was. Oh, we had 10-foot high, supposedly unclimbable fences all around the compound and that sort of thing. But, you know, it wasn't until that when the news was eventually let out, I think, quite late on in the war, that we had such a thing called radar and what it had done. So well remember my father saying to me, "Oh, is that what you were doing at Southend before the war?" No, he didn't know. He certainly never knew from me, and he didn't know from anybody else. And so it was. I reckon it was the best kept secret of the war. Very tight security and. Everybody in it was with respect, they were regular Air Force. They were used to keeping their mouths shut, and they did. I'm sure they did.
Were these 10-foot-high fences really unscalable then?
Oh, no. They weren't really, but you would have to... you'd probably make a bit of clatter getting over them and that sort of thing, and we were quite well guarded apart from the 10-foot fence. And then, of course, as soon as the Czech crisis blew up, we had an army guard posted in, and so there were soldiers all over the place with guns and things.
What were you personally trained to do at Bordsey Manor?
Oh, I was trained to both to operate the equipment and to look after it. As simple as that. I mean, I was, after all, a wireless and electrical mechanic, and that was my job. Look after it and operate it. Because we had no operators as such at the time.
Was it easy to learn?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it wasn't difficult. It was a strain, that's all. We had, what the Americans call an A-scope. In other words, you were looking for dents in a thin blue line of light on a cathode ray tube. That's all you're looking for. And I know for the first few weeks when I shut my eyes at night to go to sleep, I could see this blue line with a little dents in it. But, it was concentrated work. Obviously, it called for a lot of concentration. And an hour gazing at the cathode ray tube at one time was quite long enough. After an hour, you came off and somebody else went on. But and of course, we found during the war that women were absolutely first class at observing a cathode ray tube. They really were.
Better than men.
In a lot of ways, yes. We rather unkindly said this was because they were less intelligent, had less to think with, but that's probably being unfair. But they were mostly, most girls make very good radar operators indeed. Very good.
You said that you were posted to Canewdon after Bardsey Manor. Whilst you were there, was there any improvement in the radar equipment that you had?
Oh, yes, it was being improved all the time. We had really the best, I think we had the best brains, the best radio brains of the country were working for us, either working for us at Bardsey Manor or working at one or two companies like Cosser on the receiver side and Metropolitan Vickers on the transmitter side. Although some of the equipment was handmade, and still handmade when I went to Canewdon, nevertheless, the proprietary stuff was coming along and being developed all the time. It was a very rapid piece of development, too. I don't know how they did it in the time, but it really was incredibly rapid. A lot of corners were cut, and of course, on the user side, I mean, we were users. The Air Force were the users. And on the user side, we had a fantastically good man at Bardsey Manor. He was then Squadron Leader Hart, Raymond Hart. He was outstanding. He was an example to everybody. He was an outstanding man. He was technically brilliant. And we all admired him no end. And on top of that, he never forgot any of his Bardsey people, any of the people who went through his hands at Bardsey. He never forgot them. He always knew. I mean, he knew me. I last met him, I should think, about 23 years afterwards. And no hesitation, out came my name. I mean, my name is unusual, and the usual spelling for my name is S-E-N-D at the end. But he always knew my name correctly, and always stopped and passed the time of day. He became an Air Chief Marshal, and deservedly so.